Hello, everyone, and welcome to yet another exhilarating episode of Cooper Talks. And I'm just trying this on a new bit of software I've got. Let's just see if this works. I've got a drum rolling. Yay! Okay, I don't actually hear that, so I don't know if it worked or not. Anyway, let's see if we can try this as we go through. I'm not going to add in too many sound effects, but to get on with the point and the focus here, I'm going to be looking today at the, not quite the very end of the Cold War, but near the end of it, the collapse of the Warsaw Pact as an institution, as a body, and also of communism in the satellite states surrounding the Soviet Union, which happened in 1989. Now, this obviously links in very much to the reforms Gorbachev had been making in the Soviet Union with Glasnost and Perestroika. And he was leading the way with this. But it's also worth just recapping a little bit of what had gone on in the satellite countries. So the ones we're talking about are Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, and have I said Hungary? Did I say Hungary? I can't remember. Oh, there are six. Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania, and East Germany. There's the six. Sorry, I had a bit of a mental fuzz there. Anyway, these were all communist states and had, for various reasons, become communist states following World War II, some by choice, some not by choice. And they had their own communist governments. Okay, so they were independent, if you like, of the Soviet Union, in that they were their own country with their own rules and governance. However, because they were all communists and because they were attached to the communist leadership, the supreme Soviet leadership in Moscow, and because it was the Soviet Union's military force, the Red Army, that basically backed up the status and power held by the individual satellite states, these communist governments in these individual countries were basically what we'd call puppet states of the Soviet Union. So although they had their own government and they would follow their own policies and do their own things, they would only do it if they were given the approval by Moscow. And we've seen throughout the sort of Cold War series that occasionally people in these countries, or even the communist government within these countries, would occasionally get a bit fed up or want to make changes and reforms. And if Moscow was okay with that, if the Soviet leader was fine, then they would make these reforms. But as we saw in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia, when these reforms went a bit too far and the Soviet leadership was feeling a bit uncomfortable, they would basically order the reforms to be ended. And if it didn't happen, they would send in the Red Army and station tanks and weaponry in the satellite country and basically impose a form of communism that would be ideal. Solidarity in Poland was slightly different, but the same principle remained. So you have these governments in power, but they only really survive because of might, because of military force, hard power backed by the Soviet Union. They are not surviving because the people of these countries want them to be in power. And that's an important thing to remember. And in fact, as we've seen quite often in these countries, once the Communist Party in that country releases its grip, it leads to rebellion and more people wanting more reforms and basically an end to communism. So what happens in the late 1980s that changes all of this? Okay. Well, Glasnost and Perestroika have been moving at pace in the Soviet Union. And we don't know why Mikhail Gorbachev laid this out for the rest of Eastern Europe. There's many arguments that I'll look at in a second. But effectively, by 1988, things are starting to change. And countries in the Warsaw Pact, the satellite states, are looking at Glasnost and Perestroika. They're looking at the reforms of the Soviet Union. And they're thinking, well, if the Soviet Union's doing that, we're going to have to do it ourselves. And Gorbachev does tell them that they need to find their own way. the Sinatra Doctrine, their own way of surviving and making themselves popular and beloved by their own people. Now, some communist parties where the communist leadership was maybe not so keen on hardline communism in Poland and in Hungary, they actually adopted glasnost and perestroika and restructuring and openness far more quickly than the Soviet Union, and reforms start accelerating there across 1988. Other states, particularly Romania, were much more hesitant and much slower to react to these reforms. Now, all of this meant effectively an end to the Brezhnev doctrine of limited sovereignty, the idea that really these states had little power and they had to obey Moscow. So this was the Brezhnev doctrine. And it means that each of these states is going to start following its own path towards socialism. So let's remember, Gorbachev doesn't want communism or socialism to end in these countries, but instead of having it imposed on them by the Soviet Union, he's going to say, look, you've got to find a way of making it work yourselves. I'm just going to focus on the Soviet Union. Now, the symbolic moment, well, there are many symbolic moments here, but basically this change was probably best symbolized in September 1988, where Gorbachev abolished the Central Committee Department for Relations with the Fraternal Countries. This was basically the committee in Moscow that oversaw the relationship with the Warsaw Pact members. Those were the fraternal countries. And instead, relations with these countries were taken over by the International Department, which effectively is acknowledging now that these Eastern European countries are foreign states. They're no longer satellite states, and they're going to be treated just as any other foreign country would be, which means you can't just invade them whenever they do something you don't like. Now, lots of arguments. No one really knows why Gorbachev allowed this and why he did it. There's been lots of historical debate and discussion about this. I don't agree with this myself, but some people say maybe he was confident enough that communism would be popular enough to survive in some form in these countries, so don't need to have the Czechs. Another argument would be that he kind of wanted to test the political opposition and basically say put up or shut up. So in places like Poland, where Solidarity had been going under the radar, almost saying, go on then, you think you're so popular, you can do such a good job, have a go, let's see what you can actually do with a bit of freedom rather than us suppressing you, in his belief that they would fail to ignite enough support and could be easily ignored or dealt with afterwards. Another one is simply he needed to save money and stop stationing Soviet Russian troops and weaponry in the satellite countries, propping up unpopular regimes. It wasn't sustainable. It may also have been that he just doubted that the Soviet Union had the capacity or ability anymore to enforce loyalty and alliance. And do remember that in 88, this is the decision had been taken in 1986, but in 1988 they start withdrawing the forces from Afghanistan, having shown that they can't carry on this model of imposing communism on states. Another one would have been perhaps that Gorbachev needed to show that he was genuine. It's all well and good saying he's going to have openness and restructuring at home, and that he's going to build great relations with America that's going to improve anything, if he then doesn't allow the same to happen in the satellite states. So possibly this is just an extension of his new thinking policies. He said, well, if I'm doing it in the Soviet Union, to have any credibility, I'm going to have to do the same, or allow the same to happen in the satellite states. So maybe that's a reason. Now, there's also an issue. I was thinking great, deep and meaningful thoughts. Now, once this message had gone out that the countries would be free to follow the Sinatra Doctrine, to do it their way, I'm going to read you a quick quote by Gennady Gerasimov. Sorry about my pronunciation there. Soviet Foreign Ministry spokesperson who was interviewed in America on the 25th of October 1989. The quote goes, the Soviet Union recognizes the freedom of choice of all countries, specifically including the Warsaw Pact states. We now have the Sinatra Doctrine. Sinatra had a song, my way. So now every country decides on its own which road to take. Political structures must be decided by the people who live in a country, and the Soviet Union will accept the rejection of communist parties. So that's a bit after the fact, to be fair, but it sort of sums up this Sinatra doctrine and the way it's working. Now, most of the changes have actually begun in 1988. So once he'd given this message in Poland, kind of leading the way here, actually it was Hungary that really led the way, but I'm just going to talk a little bit about Poland first. Once they knew in Poland that they weren't going to have the Soviet support anymore, the communist ruler there, Jaruzelski, because Solidarity was still there in secret, it was an illegal organization, but still had a lot of members and popularity, he ends up accepting the need to have a multi-party system and to have elections. And so in January 1989, he repeals the ban on Solidarity, making it an official opposition party, if you like. And he also agrees to hold popular elections in June, the summer of 1989. He says, right, the communists are going to have to control the lower house, but we will have free and fair elections to the upper house in the legislative body. So kind of the parliament or Congress they have there. Now, when those elections happened, and this is a big deal. Do remember this. We take it for granted now, but these are the first free and fair elections to be held in Eastern Europe since World War II, really, since the 1940s. So they happen, and kind of in a big show of force and a statement, the communists who stood lost pretty much every seat. Solidarity candidates won all but one of the seats in the upper house. So that is a pretty emphatic victory. Actually, the one seat wasn't won by the communists. It was won by an independent, I think. So all the communists who stood lost. So this is a very clear rejection of communism after 40-odd years of communist rule in Poland. It's clearly rejected. And this kind of undermines that whole argument that communism was popular with the people, that it was a choice that the Polish people had wanted. Now, we've seen before in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia and even Poland in the early 1980s that usually when reforms start coming in and they start rejecting communism and what communism does, that's when the Soviet Union changes its mind and normally sends in the tanks. However, not only does Gorbachev remain true to his word and say, nope, we're not going to intervene here, he also actually goes as far as intervening in the negotiations between the Polish Communist Party and Solidarity about forming a government. The communists, despite having been absolutely wiped out in the upper house, are still trying to maintain their power and form a government. However, without Solidarity's support, there's no way they could do that. Gorbachev is actually the one who steps in and tells the Polish Communist Party that really, I mean, he doesn't order it because openness and restructuring and not telling them what to do, they can do it their own way. But he basically says, look, guys, communist, you're going to have to join a Solidarity-led government. Effectively saying it'll be a coalition, but Solidarity will be the boss. Effectively, that is ending communist rule in Poland. Okay, this is in this is during August 1989 when this happened. So that's a huge message. Now, in Hungary, a bit to the south, the first thing that the Hungarian Communist Party tried to do to try and remain in power and try and be popular was it replaced János Kádár, or Kádár, I think, K-A-D-A-R, as leader, and replace him with someone who'd be more moderate. Now, remember, Kádár has basically been the leader of Communist Hungary and is a hardliner. He's been there since the Hungarian uprising in 1956 when he replaced Nagy. So he's replaced by a more moderate, reform-minded Hungarian communist leader. Okay, I'm trying to remember what his name was now. I'll come to that in a bit. This is kind of traditionally a typical kind of totalitarian single party state where you do a change of leader, but you don't actually change policies to try and fool people that things have changed a lot. Now, the leadership changes in May 1988, and in the end, they do agree that they're going to allow multi-party elections. But perhaps significantly, the thing that they do first that really takes a big step to causing the collapse of communism in the Warsaw Pact is in February 1989, the Communist Party of Hungary... What happens first then, in February 1989, they end up abandoning the principle of single-party rule in Hungary. They say, okay, we're going to remain the Communist Party, but we will legalize and allow independent political groupings. Basically, we will allow a multi-party system with free and fair elections to be introduced. So that's in February 1989. And perhaps unsurprisingly, based on what happened in Poland and elsewhere, as they hold elections, as people are able to appoint new figures, the Communist Party consistently, on a slower scale than in Poland, starts to lose authority and control. So over the spring and summer of 1989, the Hungarian Communist Party is losing its control and authority over the country. It's in power, but it can't exercise that power. And every time it brings in a new reform that the people are demanding, and to try and increase its own popularity by saying, look at all the wonderful reforms we're doing, every time it does that, it actually just weakens its grasp on power. So they're kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't here. They want to remain popular so they can win elections, but every time they bring in a new reform, it just undermines and weakens them. But they're kind of trapped now in this progressing cycle. The big thing that they end up doing that I was alluding to earlier is, in May 1989, they will remove the security fence between Hungary and Austria. This is huge, because Austria is on the capitalist side. Now, it's not a member of NATO or any of those other organizations. It was a member of the EU. Yeah, I am right. It was a member of the EU at the time. But it's a free state. It's not a communist state, okay? And it has open borders with the rest of Western Europe. By Hungary taking down this security fence, they are basically putting a huge hole in the Iron Curtain. And what it means now is people from East Germany who were allowed to travel across the Warsaw Pact country, so they were allowed to move there and go on holidays and things like that, they started going on holiday, on vacation, to Hungary. And while they're in Hungary, they would completely freely cross the border into Austria. And from Austria, they'd travel into West Germany. And this basically is a giant hole in the Iron Curtain. And it shows that actually there's no point to the Berlin Wall anymore, because, okay, the Berlin Wall's still up. You can't walk from East Berlin into West Berlin. But what you can do is go to Hungary, go round through Austria and up into West Germany, and then take the train or road into West Berlin. Effectively, the whole Berlin Wall is now meaningless and pointless. Remember, the Soviets have always made the point that the Berlin Wall was there not to keep in communists in East Germany, but to keep out capitalists from West Germany. Okay, it was there as a defensive precaution. However, what this hole in the wall, in the Iron Curtain does when Hungary takes down the border, is it just leads to huge numbers, thousands of German tourists crossing through the border and heading into West Germany. And as the summer goes into the autumn, more and more people are making this decision. They're voting with their feet. And it kind of just shows that actually the whole Iron Curtain, the whole Berlin Wall was there to keep people in the Warsaw Pact. It wasn't about keeping other people out. And it just shows how unpopular communism actually was. The people did not love it, which was a bit of a worry for the communist government of East Germany that was quite hard line and didn't want to make any reforms. Again, much as in Hungary, the East German Communist Party says, okay, we better make a reform here. We better change the leader. Okay, we're not going to change policies, but we'll change the leader. and bring in someone new to make it look like we're being nicer and we're listening and we're making these adaptions. So the old hard line leader, Erich Honecker, was replaced by another communist leader, Egon Krenz. But it's just a bit too late now. And you might have thought, well, why don't the East German communists just open force, close the border, use their own military against their own people? Possibly they might have done, except Gorbachev makes a visit there in the first week of October. Now, at this point, protests have been starting to break out against communism in cities like Leipzig and other East German cities. And you might have expected some repression. However, Gorbachev basically keeps urging them and saying, don't open fire. You've got to win them over. We're not going to back you up if there's a civil war or rebellion. And so there is kind of a pressure from Gorbachev on the East Germans, the East German Communist Party, not to take a hardline military action. Now, eventually, what this will lead to is in November of 1989, the demonstration spread to Berlin. And on the 4th of November, an enormous demonstration takes place in Berlin. Over a million people in East Berlin travel to the Berlin Wall demanding democracy and free elections. And then on the evening of the 9th of November, the East German government officially announces the opening of the border crossings into West Germany. So basically, faced with this huge popular uprising, they know they're not going to have the support of the Soviet Union here. So they've got a choice. Either they order the East German Communist Party soldiers, the army there, to open fire on its own people, which it's not at all clear the army would have obeyed those orders or not. And that would have triggered a civil war, which could have been absolutely disastrous for all sides. Or they just had to accept it. And it shows they're just accepting the reality of the situation. They open the borders and people begin to not only cross through in a night of great celebration, but they also start to dismantle the Berlin Wall, to start tearing it down with their hands. And obviously they get tools and hammers as well. And within a few days, over 1 million people had taken the chance to go see relatives and experience life in the West and all the decadent things. And quite quickly, multi-party elections were brought in, which led to communism ending in East Germany. And kind of as soon as this happened, there was the question about German unification. And although this is kind of after the Cold War, it's worth bearing in mind, both sides, West and East Germany, want to be reunified as a single nation again, to become a united Germany, which hadn't existed since the end of World War II. Now, initially, even the USA were a bit hesitant about this, and were like, oh, I'm not sure this is a good idea. How's this going to work? How will this change the power dynamics in Europe? But with both West and East Germany wanting it, and them both having the freedom to make their own choices, it quite quickly became an inevitable thing. And Gorbachev says he would support it. So again, huge, huge turnaround. He would give it his blessing. So although it's not something everyone else wanted, Germany in 1990 will become a unified country. And then this new unified Germany would actually join NATO. Basically, there was no point to the Warsaw Pact, and that was officially dissolved in 1991. Right, so that's kind of the end of the Warsaw Pact. What about the other countries? Don't want to miss them out. Something similar to Hungary was happening in Czechoslovakia. They changed their leader. So a guy called Husák, who was a hardline communist, he's replaced by a guy called Jakes, J-A-K-E-S. Bulgaria will try the same thing when Zivkov retires. And in all these, they're hoping that a new leadership will convince people that a new form of communism might work. It doesn't. In all these countries, you end up with free elections being held, multi-party states, and the communists basically losing all of them. So I'll just give you a quick rundown. You end up with, in Hungary in 1990, you have democratic elections won by Democratic Forum, which was basically an alliance of anti-communist groups. You end up with Poland, with Solidarity, as I've mentioned, ending up winning elections in 1989. In Czechoslovakia, you end up in December 1989 with Václav Havel, H-A-V-E-L, becoming the first non-communist president of Czechoslovakia, winning these election. And basically in 1990, democratic elections to the legislature are won by an alliance of anti-communist groups called Civic Forum. And similar thing is happened. Well, there are free elections in Bulgaria and there are democratic elections, although those are actually won by a renamed communist party. So it's kind of the same power and the same people. It's definitely a socialist system, but they're rebranded as something else. But it does mark the end of a kind of strong communist state in Bulgaria. And eventually that will lead to reforms. Now, what's remarkable is in those five countries, that there wasn't any violence in the collapse of the Warsaw Pact at all. There was one exception, though. So one country was part of the Warsaw Pact, but very much under a hardline, firm, traditional communist, which is Ceausescu. And he'd been the dictator for a very long time, and there was no sign that he was going to give up his authority. Now, remember, Ceausescu in Romania had distanced themselves from the Brezhnev Doctrine. Although Romania remained part of the Warsaw Pact, it had become more distant. It hadn't taken part in the suppression of the Czechoslovakians during the Prague Spring or anything like that. So it kind of gone his own way and hadn't been quite so dependent on the Soviet Union as the other five Warsaw Pact countries or their communist governments. But following on the wave of reforms, the people of Romania, having seen all this, they want their own reforms, but they still have this hardline dictator in power. And this is the one place we do get a violent clash. So in December 1989, secret police fire on demonstrators. You then, in December 1989, there's a huge crowd in Bucharest listening to the Ceausescu's kind of annual speech before Christmas, you know, sort of annual state of the nation kind of thing. And what's weird is because this is a totalitarian regime, you'd normally expect there to be lots of cheers and stuff. It's all orchestrated. And people say, what was marked was he finished his speech and there was silence initially. And that's when people knew something was up. And that turned into boos. This is unprecedented. Ceausescu does not get boos because people that boo tend to be arrested by the secret police and never seen again. And that's when they know something is going wrong. So Ceausescu and his wife try to flee and run away, but they are captured in their limousine trying to get to the airport to escape. So this is an actual rebellion kicking off. But then between the 22nd and 24th of December 1989, the Romanian army actually joins the rebellion and fights against the secret police. So on the one hand, you've got the secret police in Romania are kind of defending Ceausescu and trying to keep communism going. They're fighting, you know, armed conflict with the Romanian people. And the big thing is the army sides with the people, not the secret police. Now, this leads to hundreds being killed in the conflict. On Christmas Day 1989, Ceausescu and his wife are actually shot by a firing squad. Now, again, there's a whole issue about justice and rule of thumb and what should have happened there. But that is carried out by the opponents of Ceausescu, which kind of takes the wind out of the sails of the secret police. Once Ceausescu's gone, what's the point in carrying on? And in 1990, there'll be democratic elections, which are won by a group called National Salvation Front, which does contain many ex-communists. So it's not that the communists completely disappear, but the idea of a communist party and a single party controlling fades away. Now, it's not really part of the remit of me here with the Cold War to start talking about what happened in the 1990s. That's kind of post-Cold War, and that will change. But over the 90s, these countries will work out their own systems. They'll develop the type of country they're going to be. They'll start modernizing. They'll start introducing and developing capitalist systems to the point where they will eventually, all those countries will end up becoming members of the European Union and also joining NATO and basically coming into the Western sphere. So there you go. That's what happens. That's the end of the Cold War, effectively, and the Warsaw Pact is officially dissolved, and we don't see any more of it. Now, there were other communist countries, Albania, which had left the Warsaw Pact, and Yugoslavia, which had never been a member of it. There will be a series of wars and conflicts where communism will end up collapsing there. And again, in the 1990s, Yugoslavia will fall apart, and there'll be a whole series of wars going on there between the constituent parts: Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Slovenia, Macedonia, Montenegro, and so on, and North Macedonia, as we can now call it. But these are all for other times and other stories. So the key thing here is the collapse of the Warsaw Pact is very clearly a consequence of Gorbachev's new thinking. And it shows that communism had never really taken root and was not that popular in these countries. And basically the communist governments had only survived because of the hard power, the military power of the Soviet Union. And once that was removed, once that was gone, those communist governments could not survive against the popular will of the people. And that would lead to the whole collapse of the of the Warsaw Pact. Now, that's not quite the end. I've got one more episode I'm going to do on the Cold War. I mean, I may end up doing a second at some point or some more detailed ones, but one more, which will take us to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And once that happens, well, there clearly is no more Cold War. So I hope this has put into some context the mammoth events of 1989 and the end of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Warsaw Pact and communism in most of Eastern Europe. Thank you very much for listening. I'm going to give myself a round of applause as I've got this sound effect. Yay! I don't know what happens if I talk over this. I've got to just allow it to go. It's going to be very exciting to listen back to this. Yay! Right. Thank you very much for listening, and I will speak to you again soon. Bye.